Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
I got a fever and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You know I hate Jar Jar Binks, Cyrus.
That's why I didn't play Jar Jar Binks.
Yes, you did.
I did not.
I heard it.
Not on the radio. I was playing that for your benefit behind the scenes.
Oh,
I played some Christopher Walken.
All right. Well, I heard that.
Yeah, Jar Jar Binks was just for you.
Oh, thanks a lot. Okay. Welcome back from vacation, Cyrus.
When am I going back on vacation, you ask?
I'm writing Mike an email right now. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call. I've got some emails I want to get through. Judith, who's listening in Austin, Texas, she says, Patrick, when I'm praying before Mass begins, kneeling in my pew, preparing my heart to receive the Lord, and someone comes up and taps me on the shoulder to remind me of a meeting or whatever, I feel just as I would if someone casually walked in a private moment. I'll just leave it that way. Well, I can understand. I think I understand what you're talking about. This is from Anonymous, listening in Maine, who says, a few days ago, you discussed the problem with Masons. Another issue confirmed by a coworker who is a Mason is that they have a longstanding tradition that they claim isn't practiced to protect other Masons from prosecution for crimes committed. The only ones they won't circle the wagons for are treason and murder. I've heard that before. I could see why there's some plausible deniability on their part, Anonymous. But in any case, Catholics and Freemasonry don't mix. Here's an email that comes in from Blake. And Cyrus, this is more for you. This is Blake listening in Madison on 1240 AM. And the subject is Rock On. He says, Patrick and Cyrus, I've been a listener of your show for several months. In hour one of the show on June 22nd, that would have been yesterday, I believe, Cyrus mentioned an angry caller who called in about abortion. I was wondering what hour and day that call occurred so I can go back and listen to it. Thanks for everything you do, in addition to the rest of the Relevant Radio team. And don't listen, he says, to the haters out there. Well, thank you, Blake. So, Cyrus, I think that's the call I had with the lady while you were away on your vacation, on your quote-unquote vacation. And so you probably didn't even hear that call, but it made quite a stir, and a lot of people reacted to it. So would you reach out to Thomas and see if we can get that posted for Blake and whoever else might want to hear it?
You got it.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. This email comes in from Monica, and she says, Hello, Patrick. I want to ask for your recommendation on books or videos for someone who is not baptized or religious and is interested in knowing about Catholicism. Thanks for your show and all that you do to evangelize. May God bless you. Well, thank you, Monica. Yes, there are a million and one great recommendations for books, videos. I would say start that person listening to Relevant Radio. Maybe say start listening to the Patrick Madrid Show, because we cover so many topics that I would think would be of interest to him or her. There are some wonderful books that are available. I would recommend books by Dr. Peter Kraft, for example. The Philosophy of Jesus would be one, or Jesus Shock would be another one. A book that he wrote back in either the late 80s or the early 90s, it's called Fundamentals of the Faith. I really like that book a lot because he considers world religions such as Hinduism and Judaism and Buddhism, for example, among others, in light of Christ and in light of Christianity. So he explains where they get some things right, but where they deviate from the truth and go off into error, and how Christianity is unique because Jesus is unique. He is God, and he claimed to be God, unlike the founders of other religions. So it's not a pushy book. It's not polemical. It's very easy to read, I thought, anyway. And for somebody who's sort of like looking at Christianity, and in particular the Catholic Church, I think that would be very helpful. So the books by Dr. Peter Kraft are always at the top of my list of recommended books. Thank you. This is... This is an email from, who is this from? This is from Janice, and she's listening on the Relevant Radio app. And Janice says, in hour two of your June 20th show, a woman called in to say that she had been lying on an altar praying when the priest came in and kicked her and told her not to do that. The next day, you read an email from someone who suggested that maybe she really meant that she was lying on the floor in the sanctuary. You said you didn't think so because she seemed pretty sure of what she was saying and that it was on the altar, or that it was the altar. However, I agree with the gentleman who wrote in. I can easily see someone in a pious moment lying down in the sacristy floor in front of the tabernacle to pray. I think what you mean is the sanctuary floor, not the sacristy, but in any case. Number one, it is very easy to say, for example, the priest was on the altar when we really mean the sanctuary. And number two, if she was indeed on the altar, how could the priest have kicked her without climbing up on it himself? All right. Well, okay, Janice, if that's how you want to read it, okay. You know, far be it for me to gainsay you. But I maintain nonetheless that the way she said what she said, in addition to my questioning her about, were you really on the altar? And she said, yes, I was on the altar. I don't think she was saying that she was lying on the ground in the sanctuary. That's possible. So I don't discount that as a possibility, but I don't think that's what she meant. Now, how could the priest have kicked her without climbing up on it himself? He obviously didn't do that. It seems the easiest solution to that is he told her to get down off the altar. She got down off the altar, and maybe he swung his foot at her. Easy and not difficult to imagine. Not good. I don't recommend that priests kick anybody, but there's no difficulty there if you ask me. But I can tell that you listen closely, and I do appreciate that. Thank you. Let's see. Let's go back to the phones, 888-914-9149. How about Marquita in Nicholasville, Kentucky. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I have a grandson who will be 12 in a few weeks. And after a meltdown about going to Mass, he said he didn't believe in God. And the reason why he didn't believe in God is because he has a hard time grasping the whole concept of a bigger person or even a God. And my grandson's autistic. He's high functioning. And at first I was really, really upset. My daughter was upset. And I realized that for him, it probably is hard just because of the way he thinks. And so I was wondering if you could recommend a book or something that might help him or help me so that I can educate mm-hmm. him in the faith. He was supposed to be confirmed this year, and he said he wasn't ready. And so later when I had talked to him, he's like, I didn't feel ready. He said, there's so much I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And he said, the concept of God is one of those things I struggle with. Mm-hmm. And being a catechist and a teacher, I find that working with children with special needs, trying to help them understand and grasp that concept is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you would be able to help me or shed some light on some books or things that I can do to help these children.
I would be happy to. I'll give you some suggestions. So number one, kudos for being such a great grandma. And not a great grandma, but a great grandma. And
thank you.
You're welcome. And doing what you can to try to help your grandson. This is good. And God will bless you for it. So let's start by a resource that will help you help him, and also some resources there for him. And that is a website called CredibleCatholic.com. And Father Robert Spitzer is the founder of this website, and he's a prolific author, a priest, obviously, but he's also a philosopher, and he has a great way of uniting philosophy and science as a way to speak to the modern mind, the modern audience, which is very enamored of science, and rightly so. But sometimes people can carry it too far, and they could wind up losing any sort of belief in God as a result of thinking that science disproves God's existence, etc. So I would go to that website, CredibleCatholic.com, And not only does it have some resources that are available to you, but also it's got a way that you can kind of in a more methodical way learn how to teach the faith and how to teach especially belief in God for people like your grandson. So that'd be one place you can go to get some formation. I also recommend that you go to, and I talked about this earlier in the program today, go to YouTube and zero in on the Aquinas Institute YouTube channel. And they have a series of videos called Aquinas 101. Now, they have other videos as well that tend to be longer, like maybe an hour long in some cases. But the Aquinas 101 videos are about between, say, 7 and 10 minutes long. I don't know that any of them are as long as 10 minutes, but 7, 8, 9 minutes on average. And they talk about things like, well, how can you know that God exists? What are some ways that you can know that God exists? What kind of God is he? How can you know that God loves you? What does it mean to love God? What does that even mean? I mean, if you've never seen him with your eyes, you've never touched him, how can you love something that you don't know? They tackle all of those kinds of issues, and it's very accessible. It's very friendly. It's not at all polemical, and it's really effective because they lead the viewer through this kind of basic rational approach to these realities in a way that's non-threatening. So that would be my second suggestion, would be to just maybe start watching some of these videos with your grandson, or if you don't live with him, you just send video or send links rather to the videos to him and let him evaluate some of these things. Now, I'm not suggesting that he will suddenly say, oh, okay, where do I sign up for the sacrament of confirmation, or that he'll have a radical transformation. Those things don't happen very often. But if nothing else, these are the kinds of rational, intellectual, and solid resources that are going to respond to some of the questions and objections that he has. So that would be my suggestion. I don't want to overload you. But if you want a third recommendation, I would recommend a book that I co-authored with Kenneth Hensley. It's called The Godless Delusion. And it takes the major claims of atheism that there is no supernatural realm, that there are no gods, certainly not the God that you and I think of as God. There are no angels or devils. There's no heaven or hell. There is no afterlife. You don't have a soul. You didn't come from anywhere. You're not going anywhere. So big picture, there is no God. And we critique that. And I won't go into detail about how we do that, but it's intended to be accessible for anybody. And your son, or your grandson rather, could easily pick up that book and begin to see that atheism is certainly not all it's cracked up to be, and that there is a way in which those who believe in God can rationally demonstrate the reasonableness of believing in God and the unreasonableness, the lack of coherence, the irrationality, I would say, of believing that God doesn't exist. So there's a third option in your box of tools there. So I'm hopeful that that will be useful to you, Marquita. I think any or all of those things will be. Thank you. Let's go now to Janet in Milwaukee. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question about Sunday's gospel.
Okay.
The feeding of the 5,000 in Luke. Mm-hmm. So I was always taught that the Last Supper was the first Mass.
Right.
But when I started rereading the gospel and then rereading the Last Supper, it seems like Jesus took the bread and looked up to heaven, broke it, gave it to the disciples. Mm-hmm. So it seems like he did that at this feeding of the 5,000 before he did it at the Last Supper.
Well,
is it the same thing?
There's a symbolism there that points forward to the to the Last Supper, but this is something different. So at the Last Supper, as you know, Jesus took the bread and took the wine and he transubstantiated it, to use a Catholic term, from bread into wine into his very body and blood. And he said so at the Last Supper, this is my body, this is my blood. He didn't do that at the feeding of the 5,000. So it is not the same thing, but the feeding of the 5,000 in Luke's gospel. We also see it in Mark's gospel. So in Luke, it's in Luke chapter 9. In Mark, it's Mark chapter 8. And then in Matthew, it's Matthew chapter 15. And there is an interesting connection here, because in Matthew chapter 15, it says, he took the seven loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. Now, if you drill down into the Greek, what you'll find is the word in Greek for giving thanks is the Greek word for the Eucharist, eucharisteo. And that's the word Eucharist is present at that event, at least the description of the event. So when Jesus, as he performed this miracle, began with this prayer, the church recognized that that term to give thanks, eucharisteo, that term became synonymous with what Jesus did at the Last Supper, where not fish and bread, remaining fish and bread, which they did in Matthew chapter 15, but at the Last Supper, what once was bread and a chalice of wine became the Eucharist, eucharisteo, by him giving thanks and transubstantiating it into his body and blood. So there is a connection. You're right about that. No doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But it's mm-hmm. two different things. And the Matthew 15 and Mark chapter 9, or Luke chapter 9 and Mark chapter 8, explanations of it, this is like a foreshadowing of the Eucharist. But it's not the same thing.
Well, I think the important thing is when he said, this is my body and this is my blood, that meant the transubstantiation occurred.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So yeah. They did receive the Eucharist. The 5,000 did receive Eucharist.
No, they did not. That's the key. That's what I'm trying to say here. So it's not the Eucharist. The word that's used there for Jesus giving thanks is Eucharist, but they did not receive the Holy Eucharist. They received a miraculous multiplication of bread and fish. And it what once was bread and fish remained bread and fish. So it was not the Eucharist. But at the Last Supper, Jesus performed a much greater miracle. And furthermore, it wasn't merely enough to feed 5,000 people or 10,000 people. It was enough to feed countless millions or billions of people all around the world all at once. So it's an even greater multiplication than the multiplication of loaves and fish. But they, sitting on those grassy hillsides on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, they did not receive the Eucharist. It was a foreshadowing
of the
Eucharist.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. I appreciate it, Patrick.
You're most welcome. Happy to be of service. And I love talking about these topics. And I'll just put this out there. If you've never made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land and you have an opportunity to do so, go. Because some of these things, like what Janet was talking about, the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes, you can see where this happened. And one of the most amazing things about that, if you read the different stories, it seems that this happened. We know it happened at least once. It may have happened more than once, because some of the details of the story are different, where you've got more people in some cases. So it's possible that Jesus performed this miracle of the multiplication of loaves and fish more than once. But regardless, he turns to his disciples after he's been preaching for a long time, and you probably know the story, but he turns to his disciples and he says, give the crowds something to eat. And you can imagine the reaction of the apostles, because this was in the middle of nowhere, and these empty hillsides, you know, it's hard to know if there were many trees in those days. Probably there weren't. It probably looked very much like it does today. It's just open, empty grassland for the most part, with a lot of rocks and, you know, some scrubby trees and things like that. But the response from the apostles is, Lord, where would we ever find enough food in this deserted place to feed all these people? And Jesus says, well, what do you have? And they say, well, we got like a fish. And here are seven loaves of bread. They're probably thinking, that's what we were going to eat. And we're hungry too. You're going to give away our food? So obviously the miracle there is not that the people shared with each other. That's not a miracle. That's nice, but it's not a miracle. The miracle was that the Lord took this little pittance of food, this just a little minimal amount for maybe a few people, And he super abundantly multiplied it for all who were there. And we're told that there were 12 baskets of fragments left over. That's a little detail that's important. We often sort of hear it and don't really think much about it. The reason that's important is that that is not only symbolic of the 12 tribes of Israel, and that the message of Jesus and his gift of himself in the Eucharist, which is coming, it wasn't there yet, that that's for everybody, it's for all people. It's not restricted for a certain group of people. But even more importantly, it points to the superabundance of Christ's blessings, that he doesn't do things by half measures. He doesn't skimp. And so the 12 baskets left over, as we read in John chapter 6, it is a sign that when the Lord is going to give you a gift, and in this case, the gift of himself in the Holy Eucharist, that he will not only give it without reserve, but it will be super abundant for you. You will have life in abundance, more than you can even use. There's more than that. So lots of beautiful connections here. And you'll notice that in John chapter 6, where we read that detail about 12 baskets left over, that is just a little bit before Jesus begins the Bread of Life discourse, when he talks about the Eucharist. And some people say, I can't believe that. And he lets them leave, of course. But he's about to teach them about the real bread that will help you live forever. Anyway, 888-914-9149. Good time for a break. And great call. Great question, Janet. Thank you. And I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. If you've been driven to tears because you haven't been able to get on the air, now is your chance. Call 888-914-9149. Let's go to Mercedes in Philadelphia. Good morning, Mercedes.
Good morning, Patrick. I am confused if John the Baptist knew if Jesus was the Messiah. It seems that he does at the end of John chapter 1, verses 29 to 36. But then in Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 to 6, when he was in prison, he asked his disciples to go to Jesus to ask if he is the one.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there are two ways to understand that Matthean passage in Matthew 11, and I don't know that they're even necessarily mutually exclusive. So let's start with the first passage. So in John chapter 1, we read in verse 29, the next day he saw Jesus coming toward him, and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man who ranks before me, for he was before me. I myself did not know him, but for this I came, baptizing with water, that he might be revealed to Israel." So it's really clear that at least at that point, St. John knows exactly who Jesus is. But note that even in that statement, he alludes to there was a time when he didn't know him. He didn't know. Does that mean that he was not sure, that he wasn't aware? Keep in mind that they did meet, so to speak, when St. John the Baptist was still in his mother's womb, as was Jesus. But there's no reason to think that they grew up together, because Mary and Joseph lived in Nazareth, which was up in Galilee. And John the Baptist was born, at least, in Ein Kerem. And so that is very, very close to Jerusalem, up in the mountains. So outside of maybe an occasional when Mary and Joseph went up to Jerusalem for the Passover, for example, to take Jesus to the temple. We only know of one time when that happened. There may have been others, but we're not told about them. So just from the biblical record, there doesn't seem to be much to support the idea that Jesus and St. John the Baptist in any way knew each other like cousins would know each other, or that they grew up together or anything like that. They were far, far apart geographically. And so to your question, when we look at the Matthew or the Matthean passage in Matthew 11, when St. John the Baptist sends his disciples, he says to go and, go and see. You know, who is this? Go find out. One way of understanding it is that St. John the Baptist didn't know. And keep in mind that Jesus' name, Yeshua, was a common name. It was not like a very unusual name the way Jesus in, American English-speaking culture would be rather unusual. It was a very common name. And so if he's getting these reports about this man named Jesus is preaching, Yeshua, preaching and doing these things, I could see where, since John the Baptist, he's locked up in prison, he can't go for himself, he hasn't seen Jesus for 30 years, he would not be sure. So that's one way to explain why he would send his disciples, so that they could come back and tell him, yeah, this is him. But there's another way, and that would be, or another way to explain it, and that would be that St. John the Baptist either had a really good hunch that it was Jesus, or he in fact may even have known that it was Jesus, but he wanted his disciples to know Jesus. So he sent them maybe under the appearance of saying, go find out, not for himself, but for them, so that they would then fall away from him and wouldn't follow him anymore, and they would follow Jesus. Because after all, St. John the Baptist said, I must decrease and he must increase. So he was pulling back. He knew, presumably, that his death was near. So he wanted to send his disciples to Jesus. So that's another way of reading that passage. And I think either or both of them would make sense of the text.
Thank you. I think that makes sense about him sending his disciples and having the disciples to realize it. So, yeah, that right. Makes sense now. Thank you. Okay. I really appreciate it.
You got it, Mercedes. Nice to talk to you. Let's go to Catherine in Tennessee. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm making a comment on a call from yesterday. You had were speaking about Catholic schools and people sending their kids, or just the way kind of like kids are indoctrinated now in public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to, kind of share my personal situation. We have two daughters, sent one all the way through 12 years to Catholic schools. Have a junior now who we are sending to a public school this year. One of the reasons is the Catholic school that she went to is, as I would say, a Catholic school in name only.
Okay.
And the cost is really becoming prohibitive for us to send her to school. So the thought is really, if we know kind of like not completely what we're going to get in a public school. And believe me, it is painstaking to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we are, completely prayerfully doing this. But as you were talking yesterday, there's another side to the story of, of all the years that we have, sacrificed and sent our kids thus far to Catholic schools. It just comes to the point where you have to make a decision. Do you finally, send to a public school when, one, you can't afford it anymore, and two, the school that you were sending her to isn't really, in our minds, a Catholic school to begin with?
Right. Nancy and I, for what it's worth, Catherine, we went through that when we were fairly newly married. Well, we had young children, and we were poor as church mice, and we really couldn't afford the whatever per month it was that we were sending our oldest to a local Catholic school. But we somehow we managed to do it. But we eventually got to the point where, because that school, that Catholic school, and this is in the 1980s, it was deteriorating and just becoming more of a headache than anything else. And they were in many ways undermining the faith that we were trying to teach them in the home. They were undermining it at this Catholic school. So it was a relief for us when we pulled them out and said, well, why should we pay this money to subsidize an education that's faulty in certain respects? So it was nice to not have to spend that money. We put them in the local public school. So we're doing it. We did exactly what you're referring to, but it was in grammar school, not high school. And that lasted for a year. And then we pulled them out of there because it was, in other ways, it was worse in the public schools. Now, this is, again, in the 1980s. Things are much worse now, if you ask me. So having been there and done exactly what you're contemplating, the solution that we found was homeschooling, because we couldn't justify spending the money on a Catholic school that was undermining the kids' faith, nor did we want to tolerate some of the things that were already beginning to be a problem in the public schools. And then it wasn't ideological. It was more, you know, the fighting and the bullying and even the beginning of drug use among some of the students. We just didn't want our kids exposed to that. So we made the conscious decision to sacrifice, and it was a sacrifice, to homeschool the kids, which my wife did. Now, that's a third option, and you didn't get to that part of the question, but I'll jump to that part and say, have you considered homeschooling as an option if neither the public school nor the Catholic school are palatable options?
We did, and I feel like we did that last year, and I feel like we're coming at it from, you know, a point where she's older and, you know what I mean? It's just a little bit, mm-hmm. late in the game, if you will.
Yeah. How old is she again?
You know what I mean? She'll be a junior.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, if I can just sort of intervene here, you have three choices because she has to go to school. You can either continue with the prohibitive tuition at the Catholic school that is substandard. Sorry to hear that. You can send her to, or rather you can homeschool her, or you can send her to the public school. So my prediction, Catherine, is you're going to trade one set of problems for another set of problems. You're going to trade the set of problems with the high tuition and a relative, I don't know, deficiency in whatever way it is in the Catholic school that's Catholic in name only to have another set of problems that won't involve those issues, but other issues like the LGBTQ ideology that's rampant in the public school system. Just read the Title IX language and what the federal government says to schools about what they must do in this regard, including the trans movement and all of those things. It's easily available online, and if you read it, your hair will stand on end. And the federal government will withhold money from school districts and schools if they don't toe the line on these ideological issues. So that's a real problem. Now, it may not be where your child would go to school, but chances are it is. And there are other problems of a similar nature. So this is where, I mean, I obviously can't tell you what to do. You'd have to make that decision. But if those are your three options, homeschool, Catholic in name only school, or public school, and the Catholic in name only school has its set of problems, I guarantee you the public school is going to have a different set of problems. And that's where your cost benefit analysis comes in. You know, which set of problems is the lesser of two evils?
Well, I hear what you're saying. I'm fully aware of all of those. You know, I guess that's just where our faith comes. You know, I'm probably being more candid than I normally would be, but I mean, she's just, you know, burnt out with church now. I mean, we're really just stuck. And, there's a lot of, there's just a lot of uphill prayer that we, that we have ahead of us. But
understandable. I deeply empathize with you and your husband, Catherine. I really do. I can imagine the turmoil that you're experiencing here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's where, I mean, I guess, you know, we just surrender ourselves, and her especially. I mean, we just have to be extremely faithful. I don't know what else to say, but I do know that when people are making their choices, they have to really invest the time to when they're choosing a Catholic school, to make sure that it is Catholic. Mm-hmm. And trust me, we were all in for so many years. And then when you start seeing things become more important than the curriculum, you know, a faith-filled curriculum, or more important than the kids going to Mass, or more important than having a priest on staff and things like that, then,
Believe me,
sports being...
We went through exactly that. You're describing what we went through, Catherine. I know exactly what you mean, and I could see why you're exasperated by
right.
it. But here's
right.
the thing.
I'll leave you
with this thought. I apologize. I've got to take a break, but may I leave you with another thought? You mentioned a moment ago
Absolutely.
That your daughter's, that she's already cooling on faith. She's sort of cooling and pulling back. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Sending her to public school is not going to make that any better. If anything, it's going to make it
worse.
Oh,
I know.
Okay. If it were me, I mean, just based upon what you're saying, I would bite the bullet and I would homeschool. And yes, it's inconvenient. Yes, it's a taxation on your time and energy. And I understand. I understand all of that, believe me. But it's like you're between the devil and the deep blue sea here. And if the Catholic school is not a viable option anymore, and the public school, as you yourself just said, is very likely to drive her further away from her faith, then I don't see another option other than homeschooling, personally. So,
well, there's a lot more to this story than I choose to share with.
I understand. I'm sure it's very complicated. Very complicated.
Yeah.
Well, you have my empathy. I assure you of that. And we have to take a break, but I assure you of my prayers. And I am confident that many people who are listening right now to this phone call will be also praying for you, Catherine, that you and your husband will make a good, wise, happy decision. For your daughter's sake and also yours as well. Thank you. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We're going to California. We're going to South Dakota and Texas and New York.
This is what I'm talking about.
Texas and New York.
Keep it going.
And Oregon and Washington and Oregon and Washington. We're going to South Dakota. We're going to South Dakota and Michigan. Michigan.
I'm looking for a Michigan call, but I don't have one. I don't have Washington, D.C. either. This is good energy, Cyrus. Man, you haven't played that in a long time. If there were a transcript of the show, how would you even spell that?
I don't know. You would mention that in passing like 3.5 hours ago. So I've been setting.
Oh, is that where it came from?
Yep, I've been setting on it all show.
That is great energy right there.
Love it.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Charles in Waukegan, Wisconsin. Good morning, Charles.
Hello.
Yes, welcome.
Pat, if you look at Matthew chapter 10, it says. Jesus specifically said, don't go to us Gentiles. Go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Heal the sick, cleanse lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. I have not seen or heard you or even like Michael Flager or anybody running around Chicago casting out devils or cleansing lepers or healing the COVIDs. And they're all going to, you're in violation of the scripture right here because this is a Gentile program. So how can you explain that? And Jesus also said in Matthew 15, I have not come but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's obvious that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John was written to Jews only. So you're not walking the dusty streets of Jerusalem, boy. You're in Chicago, and you're not. This is so obvious to me. You know, I'm just not a real. I'm not a super smart guy, but come on.
Okay, well, let's test that theory out. Let's see how smart you really are, Charles. If you have read the Bible, I'm sure you've read Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20, where Jesus says to those same apostles, he says, go into the whole world and preach the gospel to all nations. That's Gentiles and Jews alike. So you forgot that part of the story, Charles. Come on.
Paul wasn't one of those 12.
No. He said to the 12 apostles minus Judas. They were the 11 who were there with Jesus. Read it for yourself. Matthew chapter 28, 19 and 20. Jesus told those same men, okay, now it's time to go everywhere. Go to the whole world and preach the gospel to all nations. That includes the Gentiles. So there's your answer.
Yeah, but that was not, no, it's future. It's not to you and me, bro. Paul says Christ sent me not to baptize. 1 Corinthians chapter verse 1, verse 17.
Yeah. Charles, if you want to play biblical badminton, I guarantee you I will win. But I just lobbed a ball in your direction, and I don't know how you're going to respond to that. Jesus said, here and now, go into the world, the whole world, make disciples of all nations. And so that's for everybody. That's, by the way, why the church is called the Catholic Church, because it's for all people everywhere. It's universal. So there you have it. You wanted a Bible example of that, and I gave it to you. I hope that's helpful, Charles, and I really appreciate you listening. Let's go to Adriana now in Santa Ana, California. Good morning, Adriana.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. So my question is, can we take a family member off life support? We've been dealing with this because last year we lost our father and grandfather. And in both instances, they told us, the doctors, that there was nothing else they could do.
Mm-hmm.
So they told us we had to take them off.
Okay, so is he... I'm so sorry about this painful situation, Adrienne. I can imagine your grief right now. So is he being kept alive, so to speak, by like a ventilator or some sort of a machine or apparatus that's helping him breathe? Is it something like that?
Well, actually, they both passed already last year, but...
Oh, I see. Okay.
Our grandfather, he was on a ventilator, and they said they had to send him to a home, and they were going to have to make a hole in his stomach to feed him, and the family decided that they'd rather not see him and continue suffering, so they removed him.
So are you concerned? It sounds like you are. Are you worried that maybe you did something wrong by agreeing to have him taken off life support?
Yes.
Okay. I can assure you that you did not do anything wrong. And here's why. Assuming, now I'm making an assumption here, assuming that your grandfather was in fact, let's say, comatose, that he was not conscious, he wasn't able to speak to you and have, you know, have that kind of interaction with people, but he was unconscious. And if he was not on this ventilator, he would have died because he couldn't breathe on his own. The Catholic Church says that under these circumstances, you are not obligated to continue what's called extraordinary life support measures. So ordinary life support, like food and water, I mean, you can't starve somebody to death under normal circumstances. There are situations where people get so, their body is so damaged that they can no longer assimilate food, or they can no longer really assimilate any kind of nutrition, food or water. And so that's a separate kind of scenario, but all other things being equal, if somebody can eat and can sustain hydration, we have an obligation to do that. But you don't have an obligation to perpetually provide an extraordinary means of life support. which is sounds like that's what he was on. So you definitely did not do anything immoral.
Yes,
that
was...
when you agreed to that. You didn't commit
a
sin.
And then for our father, thank you. And then for our father, you know, they had, we asked that they keep resuscitating him
mm-hmm.
until he passed away. So, I mean, that's okay too.
Yes. I mean, now how old was your father when he died?
55.
Okay. A young man. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So if the physicians did everything they could possibly do to revive him and to help him stay alive, but there was no means of doing it, you know, they did the best they could, and you did the best you could. So there's nothing about that that sounds to me like there's any moral problem.
Because my husband and I were just going back and forth, like, natural death, do we just let them go, or mm-hmm. do we keep fighting and keep them on life support, I guess, is our...
Yeah.
Because it's been a couple months and we're still trying to
You're troubled
comprehend.
By it. Right. And it's such a difficult time as you're grieving. So my condolences to you and your family. But rest assured that if your father and or your grandfather were on an extraordinary measure of life support, so in this case a ventilator, and if it got to the point where there just was no longer any hope that they would be able to survive, aside from being on that ventilator, and you made the decision to take them off it, that was not a sin. It's an inevitable eventuality in the case of somebody who's in that situation. So I hope that's comforting to you. Thank you. Let's go to Diane in Minneapolis. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome.
My question was, I was wondering what you thought of the Harry Potter book series and whether you thought a person could recommend it to kids to read this summer.
Interesting question. It's come up a lot over the years. It was a really big deal maybe 20 years ago or more when they first began to come out. I only read the first volume because I wanted to be knowledgeable. And I saw, I think, the first two movies, so I could be knowledgeable. But we did not let our children read the Harry Potter books or watch the Harry Potter movies because, unlike the Chronicles of Narnia, let's say, or the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Harry Potter books are different insofar as that it is teaching the kids magic, and not just magic, but like casting spells and incantations and conjuring spirits and things that the church says is outside of what would be considered acceptable. So, you know, clearly a story of, even though it has wizards and things like that in the case of the Lord of the Rings or similar things in the Chronicles of Narnia, those books and those movies even, they're clearly fantasy. It's not intended to teach this to kids. It's not intending to say, hey, you might be, you know, secretly a wizard. Your parents are muggles, but you might have these secret powers. That's my objection to the Harry Potter books. They're well written. They're interesting, great characters, no doubt about it. I think some people, they got distracted by the high quality of the books and they thought, well, listen, my children won't read anything, but they're reading this and Harry Potter gets them to want to read and that's good enough for me. We didn't have that view, so we did not let our kids watch it because we didn't want them to go down the road of being apprenticed into this world of casting spells and incantations and trying to conjure spirits, etc., because that is a portal into the world of the occult, and that's the devil's domain, and we didn't want our kids to even think about that as something that they might want to dabble in. So for that and other reasons, but that's one of the main reasons, I personally am not a fan of the Harry Potter books. I know that I'm in the minority, but that's the view I hold.
Yeah, I have a niece who's 25, and she grew up in the Harry Potter series and loves the series. And now she, as a teacher, is teaching a summer class on Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some other resource that I can give her to say, maybe you want to hold back on that or maybe not do that? Or is there anything else out there that would, I don't know, help her realize what she's doing? I don't know.
Yeah. If she's that far in where she's actually teaching a course on it, I'm not sure how much it would change your mind. But I would recommend a book by Michael O'Brien called Landscape with Dragons. And that's a treatise on the genre itself, but in particular, kind of a critical look at the Harry Potter series in particular. It's called Landscape with Dragons. And I would also recommend, in essence, anything that Michael O'Brien has written on the topic. If you do a quick search, not only will you find things that he's written about this from a critical standpoint, but you'll also read a lot of the attempts to refute him. So there are plenty of people who didn't like what he had to say, so they wrote articles countering what he had to say. So those are out there as well, if you're interested in that. But I think that Michael O'Brien's approach to it is sensible and wise, and it, you know, very much is similar to my own approach to it.
Sure. You have any suggestions for good books, or where would I go for other good books? Like, I have grandkids. How do I keep them away from Harry Potter, but give them good books to read?
Oh, there's
tons of suggestions there where I can go get a good book? I'm sure there are. I just don't know.
Yeah, sure. I would recommend the fiction section of Ignatius Press. They have scores and scores, maybe hundreds by now, of great fiction books. Give him the book Father Elijah. How old is this person? How old is this son or grandson? It's a son, I guess.
He's 10, so he can see starting to read, and he's starting to get into some of this stuff, and I just do not have him. I'd just soon give him books that are good for him.
Ignatius Press would be my go-to place. Ignatius.com is their website. Now, of course, I recommend that you buy books whenever possible from your local Catholic bookstore. So maybe once you've gone on their website and found some of the ones you want, then buy them from your local Catholic bookstore to support them. But they have many wonderful books of fiction, perfect for that age group. I guess I'll have to leave it at that, but I appreciate the call, Diane. Thank you. I'll be back with more tomorrow, and I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.